Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for January 13th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. AETN, Fayetteville Public Library, and KUAF invite the public to a free screening of Soul Food Junkies as part of Community Cinema. It's this afternoon at 2 at the Fayetteville Public Library. In this film, the soul food culinary tradition is examined for both its significance and its consequences. AETN.com/community cinema for more information.
And KUAF's Molly Ron will be moderating the conversation after the screening.
Absolutely correct.
Ahead on this weekend edition of Ozarks, two conversations. One about the hard work of a food server. Another with a local boy turned big city urban developer. But first,
many municipalities in the area made news this week for the buying and selling of property. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more in this week's Week in Review.
Sooner or later, every city has to deal with real estate in some form or fashion. This past week, we aired stories about property being bought or sold by three area cities. On Tuesday, Fort Smith's Board of Directors voted to purchase the Bell Grove Center at 622 North 7th Street. The city agreed to buy the property from Girls Incorporated in order to create a new recreation center to be under the direction of the city's Parks and Recreation Division. Parks and Recreation Director Mike Alsup says that the city had its eyes on the property for some time.
We had looked at it, considered it back 5 or 6 years ago before the economy went into the recession and our funding was reduced, so noticed it was still for sale. So I called the realtor and looked at it this summer and made a proposal in my budget, but at the time the funding just wasn't there, and they are planning on auctioning the property next week, but they're still taking offers. So we met with the Girls Inc. Representatives and made an offer to them, and they've accepted that.
Alsup says that the property purchase is advantageous because the city doesn't currently have any all-ages recreational facilities.
We have one at Girls Incorporated facility. We have several boys and girls clubs. They all deal with the children and youth of our community, but there's really nothing for the adults to use. So this facility will be able to be used by the adults and as well as the youth and the children. And this facility is a couple of miles from the closest Boys and Girls Club, and there are two elementary schools and a junior high that are all closer to this facility than they are at the Boys and Girls Club that's a couple of miles away.
In addition, Alsup says that the facility is strategically well-placed, considering its location in the downtown historic district and its close proximity to two elementary schools and one junior high school. The facility will cost the city just more than $100,000, but necessary renovations include replacing the roof, bringing the facility's pool up to code, renovating restrooms throughout the building, and repairing water damage. Those renovations could cost an estimated $1.4 million. In other property acquisition news, the city of Bella Vista may soon be the proud new owners of three buildings and land already being used by the city's police and fire departments. In a special meeting Thursday morning, the Bella Vista Property Owners Association's Board of Directors voted to accept an offer from the city to purchase the buildings, though as the buildings are common property owned by the association, association members must first be asked to approve the purchase. If members do approve the deal, Bella Vista Mayor Frank Anderson says that both the POA and the city would benefit from the transaction.
It will help them out from the standpoint of getting them out of any of the maintenance for those buildings. It will give them some monies for the value of those buildings. From the city standpoint, it will get us into the real estate business. Currently, we own no real estate other than if you consider the roads and the rights of way for those roads. That's the only property that the city actually has control over within the city limits.
The city council offered to pay almost $1.6 million for the land and buildings located off of Trafalgar Road, Glasgow Road, and Town Center. Anderson says that there's more than one way that the city could foot the bill for the real estate.
We have the ability, I think, to finance if we want to go that route and not make an outright cash payment. We could probably, based on my estimation, and obviously we'll have to deal with the city council and figure out what their druthers are and how they would like to go about the purchase, but we have the capability to pay outright for the building, the offer that was made.
According to a news release by the POA, it could be quite a while before the transaction is complete. In the meantime, the city will continue to pay its monthly rental rate to the association. But cities are as apt to sell real estate as they are to buy it. As we told you earlier this week, the city of Fayetteville is considering a deal that would see the removal of an eyesore in the eastern part of town and the construction of a shiny new business. The city council is set to consider a sale of nearly 2 acres of the former Tyson Mexican Original plant to Iowa-based Come and Go. Fayetteville City Attorney Kit Williams says that the city is offered to sell the parcel for $900,000, and as part of the agreement, the city will share with Come and Go the cost of demolishing the old factory and other necessary land improvements.
They will pay up to 25% or up to $100,000 of the demolition costs, and it looks like there's a second commercial lot that could be sold that would have frontage on Happy Hollow, another 2-acre lot there. Well, in order to properly access it and safely access it, we wanted to have a road that would come in from the intersection into this whole 10-acre area with a lot on either side of the road. And because of that, since we don't have another developer yet or purchaser on the other side, the city owns that, so we were going to split that, and we have tentatively agreed to share that 50-50 with Come and Go.
That means that the cost of constructing all of the roads surrounding the Come and Go will be split between the company and the city, though Come and Go would shoulder the cost of improvements to Ray Avenue to the east or of additional lanes on Highway 16. The city originally purchased the entire 11-acre campus in 2004 for $1.1 million. Right-of-way acquisition and construction of new fire and police stations were reasons the city bought the land nearly 9 years ago. But with the new Fire Station 3 completed in 2008 and renovations to the existing police station on Rock Street, the old factory has stood mostly empty. But Williams says that one of the best parts of this land deal is that the eyesore that is the abandoned tortilla plant will finally be gone.
It's been vandalized. It's almost impossible to secure. The wiring has been stolen. Many pipes have been stolen, and it's got some inherent dangers in it because it has pits in there, and of course it's dark. And so it has been a problem for the police to keep it safe. They've had to go out there many times to try to get loiterers out and other people out that actually might injure themselves. So it has been a problem for the city, and there's been an overall desire of the city to try to make that whole lot look better by removing that structure.
The Fayetteville City Council is expected to discuss the land sale at its next meeting this Tuesday. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
It's always fun to report the local boy or girl makes good feature, and in this case, we're talking about Charles McKinney, a native of Springdale who grew up to become principal urban designer for the City of New York Parks and Recreation. He occasionally comes home for the holidays, and this year, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich invited him to walk and talk about his city life.
The day before Christmas was cold and gloomy, but Charles McKinney was dressed for it, wearing a puffy black down parka, perfect for a short hike along the Fayetteville Trail, just down the hill from the radio station.
The nice thing about Fayetteville is there is this characteristic, old houses that are a little worn, with real trees.
Now that's exactly what a trained architect with urban landscape proclivities might say, and it was growing up on the hills of Northwest Arkansas that inspired him most.
I grew up in Springdale. My grandfather ran the Mount Sequoia, the church camp here. So that was a pretty formative experience because he was a bit of a philosopher and also a carpenter. And when summer came, then I would be able to have the run of Mount Sequoia.
The forested Mount Sequoia Retreat Center, just east of downtown Fayetteville, made a big impression, evidently. Even though young Charles McKinney matriculated into architecture school at the local university, from which he graduated in 1980, he instead, coached by a mentor, pursued a master's in urban design at City College of New York, where he scored a paid internship in the Parks and Recreation Department.
It paid enough for my apartment, which was a fifth floor walk up 82nd and York, and working hard in school, and I worked hard at the Parks Department, and I worked harder than anyone because I had that Arkansas work ethic.
He clearly acquired his work ethic from his dad, Charles McKinney Sr., a highly regarded druggist and longtime mayor of Springdale, who passed away in 1973. His mom is gone too, but his siblings continue to live here in Northwest Arkansas. His graduate school internship led to a position as master planner for New York City's park system, focused on the restoration of Riverside Park, and McKinney called for public participation by the local community. The four-mile-long parcel from Lincoln Center to the George Washington Bridge along the Hudson River is said to be Manhattan's most spectacular waterfront park.
My education was architecture, not landscape architecture, but I was always... Well, I was always more interested in the space in between the buildings. Really treasure that, you know, early experience, because together we made a master plan that had the confidence of the community and therefore won easy funding from the elected officials.
First established in 1875 by Frederick Law Olmsted, the founder of American landscape architecture and designer of Central Park, Riverside Park was later improved upon by master builder Robert Moses during the Works Progress Administration. Over the eras, the sloping park has historically provided tranquil haven for New York City dwellers.
But as time went by, there were no people to maintain it, and the park was mostly bare. And the elm trees that were on Riverside Drive, this beautiful boulevard, were all dying, and they would have all died had there not been a citizens organization, the Friends of Riverside Park, to save them. So they saved these trees, and they turned up the heat on the elected officials to do something about this resource.
And public participation and community vision continues to be a central organizing principle for Charles McKinney, who works to connect parks to neighborhoods, creating safe, accessible, and relevant spaces for local culture while protecting the natural environment. After that huge venture, Charles McKinney was ready for a break and applied for and received a Loeb Fellowship at Harvard University for a year. But when he returned to Manhattan, he had to retool.
Tried to come back as the chief of design, and they hired someone else. And then that person left, and they hired me the second time. So for 4 years during the Bloomberg administration, the really peak period of the Parks Department, where the mayor put, well, we did our plan 2030. That means we're going to plan for another 1 million people. And we wanted a playground within a 5-minute walk of every neighborhood. We wanted to complete our regional parks. We wanted to plant 1 million trees. And he also had an interest in design excellence. So we were able to pick up some new designers to do some major new parks that looked like the 21st century.
The initial targeted annual budget was $200 million, McKinney said. The ambitious year-long Northern Manhattan Parks 2030 Master Plan, led by now principal urban designer Charles McKinney, covers 678 acres of parkland, featuring forests, wetlands, saltwater marshes, and 9 miles of waterfront, inhabited by 250,000 people.
So the neat thing I learned from the mayor is that this is an investment. And whenever we noticed that whenever we built a new park, that we built the investor confidence across the street. So you would have people who are willing to invest then in their apartment buildings. And the parks is a real low-cost way to increase investor confidence. And that is so important when people have their doubts.
One example is the High Line, a nearly 2-mile-long abandoned elevated railway emancipated by city planners and local landholders as public space and trail 10 years ago on Manhattan's west side. The Design Trust for Public Space, based in New York City, was a collaborator on the High Line project. Susan Chin is the new executive director. She and Charles McKinney also happen to be husband and wife. Previously, Susan served for 23 years as Assistant Commissioner of Capital Projects at the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, guiding a billion-dollar capital program for over 200 cultural institutions across 5 New York City boroughs. Back in 2008, Charles McKinney collaborated with the Design Trust for Public Space on a 4-year-long production of a 21st-century parks design manual, a blueprint for sustainable park design, construction, and maintenance, one of the first of its kind. The couple keep an apartment in the city, and McKinney's daily commute to work is really kind of wonderful.
Our office is at 64th and 5th, right inside Central Park, right next to the Children's Zoo and the Arsenal. The Arsenal was there before Central Park. I feel lucky every day. I get on the train at 103rd Street, where Susan and I live, on the west side on Riverside Drive. And I ride with her to 72nd Street. I give her a little kiss on the train, if I can reach her. And then I'll get off and I walk from there across 72nd Street through Strawberry Field. And then I walk under the little Delacorte clock by the zoo that has usually already chimed 9 o'clock. I try to be there, but it's usually, I've heard it ring already. And then around and under the locust trees and then up the marble stairs into the building.
Charles McKinney looks up at the trees surrounding us, many broken from the massive ice storm of 2009. Now a tangle of invasive species, another kind of insurgence taking place on urban forests, he said.
The current park that I'm working on, Van Cortlandt Park, has the oldest successional piece of forest in New York City, highly threatened now with Norway maples and bittersweet and multiflora rose. And it is a full-time job for 5 or 6 people to just keep it stable. And the master plan we're preparing says we want 100 people for a year to get that stuff out of there, or else we're going to lose it in 20 years. The invasive species are green, but they are devastating.
Helping Charles McKinney and park staff keep invasive plants and trees at bay are a trove of New York City volunteers. McKinney said any municipal leader listening to this story should take note, calling on local residents to adopt a park.
I'm a big believer in volunteerism. I have, in Riverside Park, we had 80 sites that were adopted. I have a 2-block site that I take care of, and I can keep my invasive species under control, and it's a complete joy. I don't belong to a gym. I do my gardening.
Charles McKinney said this was his first time to walk on the Fayetteville City Trail, now part of an ambitious 36-mile-long Razorback Greenway Trail complex, reaching from South Fayetteville north to Lake Bella Vista.
If you allow me to say, I think that's incredibly heroic. It's just so far-thinking, and I have to say that new path around the Fayetteville Lake and the Botanical Garden, and I understand there's some property being acquired up on Mount Sequoia, so those pieces, once they're acquired, these opportunities come and then they're gone.
McKinney travels and lectures widely about his life's work, encouraging other urban planners to adopt sustainable and collectivist parks practices. In the magazine Landscape Architecture, summer 2010 edition, Charles McKinney was quoted as saying that landscape architects need to play a greater leadership role in the ecological health of American cities and the ecological services that parks can provide. And they are fortunate to have Ozarks native Charles McKinney and his sustainable New York City public parks as a template. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you'd like to learn more about the work of Charles McKinney, you can just search the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation. This weekend, Opera Fayetteville returns to the Stella Boyle Smith stage on the University of Arkansas campus with two performances of Dead Man Walking. The production is the second for the company, following last year's staging of Little Women. The company itself is the production of Tamara Ryan, the founder and general director of Opera Fayetteville.
I've learned mostly what a wonderful joy it is to bring a bunch of people together and make this beautiful opera. I've gotten to know what it's like to coordinate lighting people and sound people and sort of all the different steps that you need. Last year it was kind of one emergency after another, and this year we had a little more of a plan.
This second production, like the company's first last January, is ambitious in almost every way. Cast and crew are assembled from afar and trickle into Fayetteville in the days between Christmas and New Year's. The orchestra, under the direction of Robert Mueller, is more than 30 musicians strong, and the opera chosen for this weekend, Dead Man Walking, is a dark, contemporary work based on a true story of violence, forgiveness, and acrimony. It is an account of the relationship between Sister Helen Prejean and convicted murderer Joseph de Rocher, first recounted in the nun's book and later in an Oscar-winning film. Tamara Ryan says the work, with music by Jake Heggie and libretto by Terrence McNally, is exactly the opposite of what she originally wanted for the second Opera Fayetteville production.
I spent the entire spring sitting down, and I made this elaborate chart, and I listened to all of these modern operas with the libretto, and I had kind of, you know, we need maybe a smaller orchestra, and we need not to have too much of a chorus requirement, and there can't be an elaborate set, and I was sort of checking off boxes, and tallying. I had a scoring system for what would be most appropriate. And then I listened to Dead Man Walking over the course of 3 days, just completely inappropriate for all of those reasons. And I was done, and I was sitting in my living room crying, and I just felt sort of a tug on my soul, and I thought, well, okay, this has to be it.
That artistic merit triumphed in her selection over pragmatism isn't a shock. Tamara's goals for Opera Fayetteville include staging recent English-language operas with rising talent gathered from across the country. But for the show's director, Kyle Lang, the choice represented an interesting state of affairs. The intense opera, with many scenes set inside a prison and an act of brutal violence that opens the show, had to be created inside the intimate setting of Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall. He uses almost the entire space as stage, allowing the prison warden to lead Sister Helen down off the stage and around the venue and back to simulate a tour of the prison.
Well, that had to do with the space itself. the set is super minimal. And there are 17, almost 18 scenes, because the end of the Act One finale is almost... I treated it somewhat as a different scene than the scene prior. There's so many scenes that you have to keep it moving. And I was forced to find a way to, without a set, change location and also give the opportunity for those small scene changes to happen as far as the set goes.
Dead Man Walking was commissioned by the San Francisco Opera and first staged in 2000. The work is filled with characters forced to grapple with issues of death, capital punishment, brutality, revenge, and compassion. Lindsay Anderson, who lives in New York City, is Sister Helen in this weekend's production.
It's been a journey, to quote the aria that I sing, learning about Sister Helen, and it's made me feel, you know, like a better person almost, because it's forced me to think about this question. That's something we wouldn't have to deal with on a daily basis, whether or not I could be able to support this person who committed such a horrible act, and to put aside my personal feelings about it, to sacrifice that for the greater good and for God. And I'm not sure if I could do it still as myself, but it really makes me admire Sister Helen for being able to do that.
Kyle Lang, the director, says Lindsay Anderson and Daniel Schofield, who has the role of Joseph de Rocher, the condemned murderer sentenced to die in Louisiana's infamous Angola Penitentiary, were among the first cast members to arrive in Fayetteville and have both been fully engaged in fleshing out their roles.
But no, the subject matter is so dense, it's so heavy, and these characters are very... They seem very simple at first, but come to find out they're very layered emotionally. And I think, you know, as for them, it changes a lot as the show develops. And it's just layer on layer. And that is reflected in the libretto. It's reflected in the music as well. And it's very dense. It's very intense.
Daniel Schofield from Binghamton, New York, has the difficult task of showing us a man convicted of a gruesome, almost unimaginable crime, but asking for spiritual guidance from Sister Helen.
We see this sort of repentant side of Joseph, and he's been living this lie in prison that he's tricked himself into believing that he hasn't done it, and he's never really lived up to it. And so we see this repentant, sympathetic side to the character the entire time. However, for the audience, it's got to be strange for them because they saw him commit this despicable act in the first few minutes, and then for the rest of the story, they're made to feel sorry for him. So, and that's kind of the challenge of the role, is to be able to play both sides of the character.
Another challenge? Crossing the stage and singing while in handcuffs and leg irons. His scenes take place inside the maximum security prison.
It's a challenge to move. Honestly, I mean, we blocked for the last week, and I didn't have any ankle cuffs or handcuffs, and now I find my mobility's a little bit more limited. I can do less jumping jacks on stage. It's harder.
Kyle Lang, the opera's director, has been assistant director for productions at Central City Opera and Opera Baltimore, and has danced at the Metropolitan Opera, Lyric Opera of Chicago, and Santa Fe Opera. This, though, is his first director's job. Even though he now lives in Washington, D.C., he has a geographical connection to Dead Man Walking.
I grew up in Louisiana, and actually grew up going to Angola to the prison rodeo every October as a child.
Music is riveting, measures change often, and choruses from different parts of the room create chilling tapestries. And the finale, referred to in the title of the opera, is a condemned man's fate. Again, Kyle Lang.
So because of the space, having the orchestra take up the entire stage left, I was forced to really pull it out into the audience, which initially, I'm not going to talk about the finale because it's pretty chilling, but I had already had a previous idea for the finale, which when I got to the space, instantly I was like, oh, this is going to work. So
this weekend's production is the second for Opera Fayetteville, and Tamara Ryan, the founder of the company, says she really isn't allowing herself to think about the third production, presumably in January 2014, but she's pretty sure she'll be thinking about it soon.
Even though I live in Boston, and because I have a singing career and that needs to happen sort of in a metropolitan area, that's where I live, but I really love Fayetteville, and I was so attached to the idea of bringing this dream here last year, and having done it once, I got way more hooked even than I thought it would be. I think last year, to some degree, it was an experiment, and I thought, you know, you'll have this amazing experience, you'll put this together, and if it turns out to be a horrible mistake, what a glorious mistake to make, and you'll just move on. Yeah, and even in terms of my own career as a singer, I keep thinking, you know, maybe you'll do a few shows and then you'll pass the reins on to somebody, you'll kind of get it started. But the more I work on it, the more I just feel sort of so in love with this baby.
Fayetteville Opera's last production of Dead Man Walking will be on stage at Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall on the University of Arkansas campus this afternoon at 3. Tickets are $18, available at the door. More information can be found at operafayetteville.org. And it should be noted that this afternoon's production includes mature themes and language.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. So, Kyle, January is Be Kind to Food Servers Month.
I think that's a good designation.
You know, I've tried to kind of do a look ahead as to special days or weeks of the month, and I was really excited to find this because I was a waitress on and off throughout college and then for 5 years after college.
My wife, Laura, was in high school a waitress and was a hostess at Powerhouse Seafoods when it opened when she was in college. So, and almost everybody I know has worked in the food business in some capacity. I have not, but almost everybody I know has.
And I used to always say everybody should work in food service.
You're probably right.
Because, I mean, you gain an appreciation for the hard work that it is. It's hard work.
I have had this idea that someday I would like to see just how well I would do or how well I would not do, but I don't think I will.
Okay.
I will take your word for it that it's hard.
It is. Well, to celebrate, I brought in a good friend of mine, David Jelinek. He has been a server at Mermaid Seafood Restaurant in Fayetteville for 6 years, and we actually used to work together. So here's our conversation.
Well, you know, it's actually kind of a hard job. We do it because we love it. I think people, you know, that start off as servers and feel like it isn't a fit, you know, that is fair enough. But then there's people like I would say you and I, we started serving tables and we just enjoyed engaging customers and just the people we worked with. And it was just a fun environment. But there are some hard times when, you know, there's a lack of management. When things just kind of go skew, and then just, you know, the non-average, you know, customers that don't normally go out, and then you see that in a reflection of your 5% or 10% tip. And so that's kind of it kind of hurts your ego a little because you feel that you've really given as much as you could to this certain table, and then you finally open your, you know, ticket book and you see, you know, a dollar on, you know, whatever it is, $50 or $40. And to them that they may think that is a good tip and they just may have never worked in that industry.
Right. Well, you say, I mean, tips, your income, we'll kind of reiterate that your income, I mean, is 100% from
tips.
From tips.
Yes.
And you say 5 or 10%. And I know some people always, they don't know. I mean, you said that's normal to them. But what is expected? What is...
For good service and just for a whole dining experience, depending on what restaurant you go to, but, you know, a restaurant like, you know, that I work at, a local eatery, has you know, good food, decently priced, has a nice building. You know, you're going there not only for the food, but you're going there just for the experience as well. Honestly, to be fair, I think 18% is fair. You know, if everything, you know, went as expected, 20% is fantastic, and anything above and beyond that is just, you know, great, and your server is more than likely going to remember you, and if you come back in, it should be the same experience or a little bit better. But, you know, 15% can also is also given, and that's about where I draw the line. And then anything under that, that's where it's like, what did I do wrong?
You know, right.
What I don't understand exactly what was supposed to happen. But like you said, the economy, people just don't have as much money to, you know, leave tips and all that. So
what a lot of people don't realize also is that sometimes you don't get 100% of that tip. You know, if there are busboys or bar staff or the hostess, that sometimes you have to give a portion of that to those workers as well.
Right. You know, exactly. I mean, we do have to tip out, you know, back of the house and, you know, different people in the front of the house. And so just for example, you know, just your liquor sales and you're getting that from a bartender. You're getting your drinks, you know, whether it be a bottle of wine that you present or they make a martini or something like that. 5% of that actually goes of the liquor sales. So if you, you know, buy a $10 drink or whatever, 5% of that is going to go to
Tip out the bartender.
Right, of 5%. And so, yes, basically if I was selling only liquor and, you know, someone gave me a 20% tip, I'm only getting 15%.
Right. So that's just, I mean, that's something to consider when people go out to eat, that if you do order, if you're at a restaurant that has a lot of staff, that your server isn't taking home that entire amount.
So that's why I love this month.
Yeah. Since you work in your typical restaurant, I mean, I know you're not an expert by any means of how to tip in different places, but it's something that people sometimes ask, you know, like at a buffet or something, you know, how much do you think people should tip at a buffet?
You know, honestly, I don't know the exact percentage, but you are serving yourself. You know, I guess they're bringing you drinks and they are cleaning your table. You know, all the in-between that I really feel my job really constitutes, which is engaging the customer and talking to the customer, you know, learning about the customer, remembering their name, you know, creating a relationship. And that's what I think serving really is a business of relationships. And so I think when you cut that out, yes, I think the percentage should be dramatically cut. And I would think, you know, because a buffet, they're not solely living off of the tips. They're probably being paid a higher wage.
Right.
Now, it may just be minimum wage. I'm not sure what they get paid. But I would definitely, cut the percentage, accordingly as far as, what you get out of it. You know, if you go to one restaurant, Mermaids or something like that, and then you go to a buffet, you can kind of gauge, what experience you received.
Yeah.
But definitely take care of them. I mean, even if it is a buffet or something that's a non-traditional type, restaurant where you're being served, I would definitely tip, somewhere between 5% and 10% to at least give them, 10%, even I'm always a 10 to 20 percenter no matter what they do. But someone who's not in the industry, I would say, if it's a delivery driver, at least 10%,
You mentioned building a relationship with your customers. And I mean, even if it's, I know and I'm sure you still do. I say we because, again, I worked at Mermaids for so long. But you have a lot of regulars that come in. And so you're building that relationship over time. But then also, it's also just building a relationship over that 2-hour period that somebody's eating.
Right.
And I would like to kind of compare, I think that there's a comparison between what I did at Mermaids and what I do here. It's talking with people and that's what I do here also is just I meet people and talk to people and ask them questions. And it's very similar for sure.
Well, and honestly, I think it's, I just recently graduated college and, that is something. Because I do have experience in the restaurant industry.
Interpersonal skills.
That's the biggest thing that I push. I didn't really intern or do anything, that maybe a traditional student would do. But I feel like I gained a lot of skills when dealing with people and being able to read people and knowing how to come at it at different angles and getting somebody out of their box and actually discussing or, into a conversation. So I completely agree that that's something that I will never lose, and that's why it's a great industry, I think, for young people to be in.
Another aspect of this, not just the tipping, but I want listeners to realize that you're not just going in at 5 o'clock when the restaurant opens, and you're not getting off at 10 o'clock when the restaurant closes.
Right. I mean, there's an hour, possibly two, depending on what day it is, that you're in there. Prepping for, the shift. And then, afterwards, there could be 2 to 3 hours of just cleanup, depending on what restaurant you work for. Luckily, I work for a great restaurant and, we all work well together. But honestly, there have been nights that we have been there for 3 hours. And you have to think, that's 3 hours, which, yeah, depending on the night, you could have had a good night. So it's not really a big deal. Or it could have been a really, slow night, but you still have all this cleanup to do. And you're making whatever an hour, you divide that by 8 or 9 hours that you've worked. And so it definitely is not just a 4-hour shift that we're there and we make money. I mean, it does take time to set it up and break it down and then do everything in between.
And you say 8 or 9 hours, and it's not just 8 or 9 hours. Like me right now, I'm sitting in my chair behind my computer.
Right. It's constantly running.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I had a pedometer, but We basically, take however many steps in one shift. And so it's good exercise, needless to say.
Another good life skill that I think that you learn as a server is multitasking. I mean, you mentioned running back and forth, but you have to multitask. I mean, you have how many tables at one time during a busy shift?
That depends too, but I mean, a lot of times it could be 5 to 6 tables, and they're not just, small tables of 2 or maybe 4. Some of them, a couple of them could be 6 to 8 people, or even a, 10 to 12 person table. When you do, go through your section or, you've taken an order, going through a typical server's head, hopefully a good server, they're going to have just this list of everything they need and what they need to do and then prioritize it. Like, okay, I'm going to be passing by, table whatever, 17, and then I'm going to be passing by table 19, and then I'm going to be over there at 30. And so in your head, you have to go back there and get the right drinks and get all the condiments and whatever has been asked for and do it in such a way that you can actually drop it off on your way to, whatever, maybe your 10 or 12 person table to take their order. You have to do several things basically at once.
Right.
And do it strategically so you don't actually waste a step.
Right, and you never want to go into the kitchen with empty hands, and you never want to go out of the kitchen with empty hands. I mean, because you're wasting time, you're wasting space.
You want to try the best, and even if it's not your own table, I mean, it's all about teamwork, and, you know, someone's going to run my food or, you know, refill my drinks, and, you know, so I'm going to do the same for them. So definitely, if you can pick up a plate or, you know, bus a table on your way back into the kitchen while you're trying to get something done, that go in there with full hands and try to leave with full hands. You know, if there's food in the window, take it out. Make sure it's hot for the customer, because it may not be your customer this time, but more than likely it could be yours. You know, they could be coming in next time. You want them to have the best experience possible.
We talk about having numerous tables at one time. How difficult is it if you have, say, that table 12 was upset? Maybe their food, maybe their soup wasn't hot enough, and they're really upset about that, you know, cold soup. And then you have to turn around and go over to table 19 and have a smile on your face.
And they've probably heard, you know, like maybe. Yeah. No, definitely. That is hard. And, you know, I don't think there's ever a definite, you know, way to combat that. But I have always thought and have been taught that go to the table that's actually, you know, mad maybe about their food or the quality of it or just whatever their issue is, and talk to them like real people. I mean, they understand. I mean, if you can sort of explain it to them, you know, they may not know all the ins and outs of the restaurant, but explain to them, you know, I apologize, you know, this is what happens, and more than likely you can get the customer to understand what had happened. They'll stay, they'll eat, you know, and I always say fix it with dessert. You can always fix an issue with dessert, you know. Make sure their, you know, initial experience is good, but then top it off and, you know, apologize once again and give them a free dessert or, you know, something to remember it. Leave a sweet taste in their mouth. As far as turning around and going to another table, you just don't let it faze you and just try to give them the best experience as possible, even knowing that they know that something wasn't right with the next table. Just make sure, go through the motions, and make sure it doesn't happen to them.
As it is Be Kind to Food Servers Month, for listeners that have never waited tables, what's like one thing that you really would like listeners and restaurant customers to know?
That this job really is, and for a lot of people out there, it is their career. This is supporting families, and this is, you know, feeding, you know, their children and just households just like yours. And so this really is a real job that people have to work, and it isn't as easy as it seems. If it may seem like we're just putting food on the table and, you know, drinks, you know, in your hand, but really there's a lot of socialization skills that are needed to actually deal with every different type of person that comes in. There's the people that want to sit and talk with you forever. There's people that just don't really want you in their business at all. And, you know, you really have to be able to gauge that and know that and almost be able to read people's minds. So just understand that we are working really hard, and this is something, you know, a lot of us take pride in. And it is a real job just like any other job out there.
All right. Thank you, David.
Oh, thank you.
Waiting tables and cooking in a restaurant kitchen are not always depicted as fulfilling jobs on television or in the movies, at least not in many recent films or shows. Still, there have been several references to restaurants, kitchens, and related subjects, enough to make up our first Weekend Ozarks at Large montage of 2013.
A bottle of whites, a bottle of red, perhaps a bottle of rosé instead. We'll get a table near the street in our
waiter. Yes, may I help you?
The wine, please.
Oh, you mad impetuous think it's champagne.
Not exactly. Sparkling Muscatel. One of the finest wines of Idaho.
You know what, Stan? If you want me to wear 37 pieces of flair like your pretty boy over there, Brian, why don't you just make the minimum 37 pieces of flair?
I work in the kitchen from 8 till 10. Go home for a minute just to do it again. How did I find peace of mind? I'm not even living on my own time.
I'd like the chef salad, please, with the oil and vinegar on the side and the apple pie a la mode.
Chef and apple a la mode.
But I'd like the pie heated, and I don't want the ice cream on top. I want it on the side, and I'd like strawberry instead of vanilla if you have it. If not, then no ice cream, just whipped cream, but only if it's real. If it's out of a can, then nothing.
Not even the pie?
No, just the pie, but then not heated.
Uh-huh.
There's fryers, broilers, and Detroit and barbecue ribs. But the treat of the treat is when they serve up those fine 8 beats. You'll want to spend the rest of your brights down at the house of blue lights.
May I help you?
Yes. This is not the best breakfast I ever ate, and I'd like my money back.
I believe you have to fill out a form for that.
No, I'd like my money back now.
I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. You see, I have to fill out a form and, well, you ate most of it already, so...
You see that sign? It says 100% guaranteed. You know what the meaning of guarantee is? Did they teach you that here?
Sir, if you just wait a minute...
Look, just put your little hand back in the cash register and give me my $2.75 back, please.
I got it used from the Navy. You could flash fry a buffalo in 40 seconds.
40 seconds? But I want it now.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's a ride.
I also want to tell you, I'm thinking about watering down the chicken soup.
How? You already use chicken like a tea bag now.
Look, I'm doing it for you.
Mel, would you like to do something for me?
Yeah, what?
Kiss my grits!
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too.
Could you identify all of those? To see a list of our 11 sources for the montage, you can go to OzarksAtLarge.com. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, January 13th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin Brown, who is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
She is.
My favorite quote right now. Not a new quote, but my favorite. A lot of people leave Arkansas, and most of them come back sooner or later. They can't quite achieve escape velocity.
And I know who said that.
Charles Portis wrote the book The Dog of the South. He also wrote the book True Grit.
And Norwood.
And he does not really come out and talk to people anymore.
He has always been a somewhat private person. Not reclusive, but somewhat private.
And that explains why Jay Jennings is going to be at the Fayetteville Public Library this week talking about the book he edited of Charles Portis's work, which is called
Escape Velocity.
Exactly. A Charles Portis miscellany.
And that's what it is. It's some of the journalism he did, both for magazine and newspaper, short stories, the one play he's written.
So a little bit of everything.
Yes. Many people who've read Portis have read those novels we mentioned, but they haven't read much of his other work. And now it's been collected for the first time in this amazing volume.
These things appeared in places like the Atlantic Monthly or the Oxford American, some in the Arkansas Times. And then pieces like the play have never – the Arkansas Rep did it in the 90s.
They workshopped it. I don't know if they actually did a full-blown production.
But it's never been published.
Right.
And so Theater Squared will be doing a portion of this.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be readings and there will be music.
Roy Reed
is going to do a Q&A, as I understand it, with Jay Jennings.
I believe so, yes.
What's interesting is that because Mr. Portis is known as kind of a recluse, people might perceive that he is not friendly. And so Jay Jennings tells this great story about being a young writer who was really only writing movie reviews for an alternative Little Rock newspaper. And he wrote to Portis saying he had just bought a copy of his latest book, Master of Atlantis, and asked him to sign it.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited him to lunch. It became a correspondence. It became a friendship.
Aww.
But he would not let Jay Jennings do the collection without a little goosing from the Butler Center.
Yes.
In Little Rock. And then the collection came about, and he stayed completely out of it. He didn't want anything to do with the editing. He was finished with his work. And so Jay Jennings said basically what he did was collect things that he loved.
Yeah, I own a copy of it, and it's something else.
And the play, by the way, is called Del Rey's New Moon. And you can find out all about this at 6 o'clock on Wednesday at the Fayetteville Public Library. It's one of those amazing things that happens that are...
Absolutely.
Free.
Yes.
Exactly. Now, this afternoon, here's some choices. It's drop-in drawing at Crystal Bridges.
Yeah.
1 to 4. You just drop in and somebody on the staff will help you draw.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
You just go draw.
Are you drawing anything or like sketching one of the paintings?
No, this is anything.
Okay.
This is just random drop-in drawing. The Sacred Harp Singers meet at 1:30 at the General Store at the Shiloh Museum. If you don't know anything about shape note singing, you should drop in on them.
Cold Mountain, the movie Cold Mountain, had a good depiction of shape note singing. It's where they move the hands and the music is written in shapes.
If you need to see a movie, Soul Food Junkies, the community cinema offering this afternoon at 2 at the Fayetteville Public Library.
KUAF's own.
Molly Ron will moderate a discussion afterward.
Excellent. If you loved the movie and you'd like to see the musical, Catch Me If You Can finishes up its run at the Walton Arts Center with shows at 2 and 7:30 today.
No Sunday night. Just
Sunday night
afternoon.
Gone. Okay.
Just Sunday afternoon.
There you go. So don't mess around.
That's right.
Go at 2.
Or at 3, you can go see Dead Man Walking.
Yes, you can.
Which seems like a really interesting topic for an opera.
Well, yeah, I saw the first half at rehearsal. And it's quite compelling, and I want to see how Kyle Lang, the director, has staged the finale. Because I don't think I'm giving anything away. It's a condemned man who is executed in Louisiana's Angola prison. If you've seen the movie, it's quite chilling
awesome
how they
movie,
do that,
yeah.
Where Sean Penn is raised up. And I don't know how they're going to do this in Syllable Smith, but I'm quite excited to see it this afternoon.
And that happens at 3 o'clock. It is the last of two performances.
That's right.
So if you fool around, this will be gone forever, and it's $18. It's happening at the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville.
Yeah. Boy, that's for mid-January, that's a great menu.
Pretty
busy afternoon.
We were looking for stories in January?
It's been a few years.
Not so much.
No, not anymore.
So get busy, folks.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Lake Francis.
Where's Lake Francis?
Lake Francis is due south of Siloam Springs along Highway 59, just a few miles east of the Oklahoma border, a little bit northeast of Watts, Oklahoma.
Is there actually a lake?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so.
All right. Lake Francis.
Lake Francis, Arkansas.
There you go.
Yes. And do you have any plans for this Sunday afternoon?
I am going to see the final performance of Catch Me If You Can
Walton
at the
Arts
Walton
Arts Center.
Yeah.
Based on the book and the movie of the same name.
Right. I'm excited to see how they turn it into how it was turned into a Broadway film. You're going to have a similar afternoon.
Well, yes. I'm planning on going to Dead Man Walking, the final performance of Opera Fayetteville. And this contemporary opera, and I'm very curious. I really want to see the second act. I saw the first one in rehearsal, and so that's where I plan to be, at Stella Boyle Smith on the University of Arkansas campus.
And both of these are the final performances of each of the shows.
Right. So
Okay.
Last chance today.
Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Callums.
Happy Sunday.